Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I gotta tell you, back in 2016, I listened to Trump's rhetoric. We're gonna bring manufacturing back. We're gonna make it in America. We're gonna recreate that power of the 1950s. You know, I've talked about it before. I've gone through Trenton, New Jersey, and there's a bridge in Trenton that says Trenton makes the world tanks. And the reality is, for a very long time, that was the absolute truth. We were the powerhouse economy. We manufactured all kinds of stuff. And over the last 40 years, it's been going away, away, away. And, well, Donald Trump promised us he was going to be the guy. He alone was going to be the guy to stop that. The question is, has it worked? Have they brought jobs back as he claims? Are we flush with manufacturing, even if you account for the COVID? Well, here to share some thoughts on that, I've asked Sarah Anderson to come talk with us. She's the director of the Global Economy Project there at the Institute for Policy Studies. They've got a new study out, How Trade Policy Failed U.S. Workers and How to Fix It. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. It's great to be here.
So let's start right at the beginning. Trump told Ohio, they told Michigan, especially Ohio and Michigan, we're going to bring those auto jobs back. The good old days are coming back. It's happy times. Don't sell your house. Don't make any other plans. We're going to do it. And yet they didn't.
But he's still going back to those states and claiming he did, which must be so painful to hear, I would think, for all of the workers who listened to his promises 4 years ago when he was on the campaign trail, saying he was going to bring those jobs back, and so many thousands of U.S. manufacturing workers in those key Midwestern manufacturing, former manufacturing powerhouses. Like you said, it must be so painful for them after they've lost their jobs to hear him continuing to brag about his wonderful achievements. When if you just look at the raw numbers in Michigan, the auto industry as a whole reduced their investment in that state by 29% over the course of Trump's period in office compared to the last 3 years of Obama's term. Their employment growth last year, so before the pandemic, was by far the lowest in a decade. And in Ohio, job growth also just plummeted. They had 36,000 new jobs in 2016. It was down to just 3,700 in 2019. And manufacturing wages have also fallen there. And so Trump is still trying to get people to believe that, you know, all his tough talk on trade and his trade wars, that has been good for U.S. workers. And in reality, even before the terrible pandemic recession hit, he was not delivering for U.S. workers.
Yeah, I occasionally go back home to Cleveland. I grew up in Cleveland. And as you're traveling on Interstate 80, there's the giant Lordstown plant that, right. you know, when I was a kid, you know, was just teeming with cars, and it was all three shifts, always crowded, always packed. Empty. It's a ghost town now. And, you know, I know people who lost jobs because they're no longer delivering things or making things that go in there. It is really decimated northeastern Ohio.
Absolutely. I quoted a worker from that Lordstown plant outside Youngstown, Ohio, Chucky Dennison. He's a longtime General Motors worker. He believed the promises of Trump initially. He and his fiance both worked for General Motors. They bought their invested in their dream home. Both of them lost their jobs. And he points out that Trump did not lift a finger to try to prevent those layoffs. I believe it was something like 14,000 in four different plants that GM did last year as they're increasing their investments in China. So for all of Trump's demonizing of China, U.S. companies have been very eager to continue to invest in that very fast growing country. In fact, U.S. companies invested $14 billion in China in 2019, and that was more than the year that Trump won the presidency in 2016. So for all of his bluster and his claims that, you know, his really brute force approach to trade, he was going to rough up our trading partners and get them to, you know, take more U.S. products, and he was going to force companies to bring jobs back home. He just really hasn't delivered. If you look both at just the data and at the heartbreaking stories of people like Chucky Dennison, who lost his job there at the GM Lordstown plant.
Yeah, you know, I go back to 2016, and I said, look, I agree with Donald Trump. I was not a supporter of his, but he, you know, the blind squirrel found a nut. We've been losing manufacturing jobs. That prosperous, unionized working class has been eviscerated. Those jobs have gone, and, you know, I argue it's our trade policy. So he was singing, you know, from the same hymnal that I was talking about. I'm in favor of tariffs. My problem is the way he used the tariffs were probably the dumbest way possible, because it was a go-it-alone strategy, and we knew that because Trump said, I alone can do it. Only I can do it, and which meant none of the other countries were going to come with us. Nobody else was going to have our backs, and it left us vulnerable, and we saw the effects of that.
Absolutely. He jacked up tariffs on things like steel and aluminum, and surprise, surprise, our trading partners retaliated and put high tariffs on U.S. goods. And so that resulted in higher consumer prices here. Our farmers lost markets abroad. And by the way, he's been trying to buy off the farmers who have been really hit hard by his trade war. And this year, the federal payments to farmers are expected to be $46 billion. That is a record. And, you know, here's the Republican Party supposed to be all about free markets. And this is the kind of payments he's using to try to buy off farmers. Most farmers I know, I'm a former farm girl from Minnesota, they don't want to be on getting all of these subsidies from the federal government. They would rather be, you know, making a decent livelihood on their own instead of having to rely on these payouts because of his very chaotic, not well thought through strategies on trade. And I agree with you, Rick. I've been working on trade a long time. Trade policy needs to be really shaken up. And so I have to say, I was nodding along with Trump a little bit in those early years with his critique of it. His solutions have not, proved effective whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, tariffs aren't the panacea. They're one arrow in the quiver. There's a lot of tools we should be using. Stopping currency manipulation, you know, stopping intellectual property theft on a certain level. Personally, if you move to China and they steal your intellectual property, tough on you. You went there, you deserve it. That's my call. But, you know, he's right. We've got a major, major problem. He just hasn't fixed it, and he doesn't have any solutions. In fact, as you've pointed out, things have gotten, you know, exponentially worse. We just had the worst trade deficit that we've had in decades. Things are obviously going in the wrong direction. How do we change it? I mean, clearly Trump's boogered this up and in the worst way possible. We've never had probably worse relations with China than we have right now. How do we move forward in this?
Yeah. Well, I'll mention a few things. One is that we need to recognize that there are huge incentives for U.S. corporations to continue to shift jobs abroad. One of those is the tax policy that Trump pushed through Congress, which actually gives an incentive to move operations abroad. You get to pay a lower tax rate than you do on your domestic profits if you have operations abroad. So we need to get rid of really perverse things like that. Companies also move abroad because they want to lower their labor costs, often by exploiting basic rights that are really human rights that should be respected for all workers in the world. Any U.S. company that's violating basic international labor rights overseas should face penalties here in the U.S. It shouldn't matter where those are occurring. It's really the companies that are playing off workers against each other, and we need to try to tackle that dynamic. But then I think more broadly, trade needs to be part of a larger coordinated national economic plan. And now is the best time ever to think about that as we're going to face the challenge of an economic recovery. We do need massive investment in things that are going to help position our economy better for the future. And do that with good job creation along the way. And so I'm really excited to hear some of the ideas people are putting out there about massive investment in research and development and, you know, sustainable technologies and new ways to really increase demand here at home. Also using the power of the public purse, making sure that our government contracts are going to companies that are creating good jobs here at home. Those, you know, good wages are going to make our economy stronger. It'll increase the domestic demand we need to really get back on our feet. So instead of just, you know, fixating on beating up on China, I think there's a lot that we can do here domestically that could position ourselves to have a much healthier, more prosperous economy that's more with more equitable sharing of the gains of our economy, instead of just allowing it to go to the executives at these big corporations and other wealthy people.
No, I'm right there with you. The idea that that our economy should actually benefit we the people instead of the kind of race to the bottom economic development we've been doing for the last 40 years that have clearly benefited the very top of the economic ladder. The other thing that I would like to see is, you know, some scrutiny over foreign capital coming into the country. I mean, you know, there are a lot of companies here in the U.S. that are U.S. in name only. They're owned by foreign corporations, and we have no idea who they are. And then they pack them up, box them up in the middle of the night, and then ship them back to wherever. At some point, don't you have to scrutinize what's being purchased in your backyard and the kind of investment that's going on? I mean, especially when you're talking about national security.
Well, I think we could be much tougher in the kind of conditions that we put on foreign investment. There are a lot of companies that have invested in the American South to take advantage of the lack of labor union power there, to take advantage of the workforce in the U.S. South. Many of these are from countries that have very strong worker protections and wage laws back home, from Germany, from Japan. All of these auto manufacturing, other kinds of manufacturing companies that have invested in Alabama and other places in the U.S. South, they don't uphold those same good practices here that they do back home. Back home, they have all kinds of innovative things like apprentice programs to allow people to, you know, learn skills on the job and really advance to higher levels. They should be doing that in places like Alabama, and we should say that that's a condition of investing there. All kinds of other, you know, strong benefits packages and things that they enjoy back home, they are not bringing those good pro-worker practices to the U.S. South. And they're investing here for, you know, because they get a lot of benefits out of it, and we should be putting tough conditions on foreign investors to make sure that those investments really benefit the local communities where they are operating.
Isn't that amazing? Because I hope people heard what you just said. There are other countries who bring jobs here because our conditions are extremely low compared to theirs. We make lower wages. We have less of a voice on the job. You know, we're now the country that is the giant sucking sound for other developed countries. We're in the middle of that race to the bottom. Now, clearly, some of those jobs continue on to Mexico and China. Mm-hmm. So this tells me we're at a moment where we need something like a new Bretton Woods Accord. We need to, you know, chuck the WTO and chuck the trade regime that we've built these last couple of years and redo this, because it ain't working for average everyday working people, not just here in the U.S., but in Germany and in the U.K. and even in China. I mean, it's not working for working people.
Absolutely. And we really need to recognize that it's not, you know, those Chinese workers who are stealing our jobs. It's not Mexican workers stealing our jobs. It's really a set of rules that have been promoted by big corporations to serve their own interests so that they can play workers off against each other. And I love the idea of really a new international framework that would set you know, much stronger protections for workers so that companies can't just play each other off against each other. Also communities around environmental issues, you know, dumping toxics somewhere because they can get away with it, and shifting production of, you know, highly toxic industries to places that have weak environmental regulations. So we do need a whole different set of incentives for these big companies so that they're not just, you know, rigging the rules to allow them to make even more profits by shifting their production wherever they can get the lowest wages and the most lax environmental enforcement. That is just not, you know, the way that our planet needs to go for the future. And, you know, I'm hoping, as horrible as the current crisis is, that it should really open people's eyes to, you know, who's really adding value to our economy? Who are the essential workers who are making the products and producing the services that really the rest of us all rely on? It's not just the people in the corner executive office suites who are adding value. It's people on the front lines, people who are doing the hard work every day. And we need to come up with trade rules and other economic rules that really value that.
No, I'm right there with you. But for me, I would love to see the change in focus be from least restrictive trade barrier, which has brought us NAFTA and CAFTA and, you know, all of the other TUS, to something of domestic production for domestic consumption. We make what we can, we trade for what we can't make, and that be the trade model. Because look, every country can make t-shirts, every country can make tennis shoes, every country can do, you know, certain things. You make that for yourself, and you trade with other stuff. I think this race to the bottom of the least restrictive trade barrier and obviously the cheapest wage and most exploitable labor and environmental regulations, it's been a disaster for the planet and for us.
Absolutely. And I see a lot of potential for solidarity, not just across borders, but between working people and farmers. I was just talking to a farmer in Wisconsin the other day saying he doesn't want to have to rely on these foreign export markets, which are always going to be fickle and unpredictable. And he points to Canada, where they have a supply management process that helps them maintain stable prices, decent, you know, pay, you know, income for farmers, stable prices for producers and consumers of those products. And he pointed out, you know, Canadian farmers are not dependent on government handouts right now in the same way that U.S. farmers are because of the disaster of the trade war. And so it's a system that's really focused on how do we ensure a decent livelihood for the people doing the hard work that puts food on our table, instead of how do we make more money for global corporations that are, you know, buying and selling around the world and producing around the world. And so it really is I think there's a lot of common ground there between the farm sector and the labor sector in our country about let's focus on the what are the domestic needs and how do we really value the efforts that people are making.
Good stuff. Sarah, I appreciate the time. Good stuff. Thanks so much.
All right.
Make sure you check out the report, How Trade Policy Failed U.S. Workers and How to Fix It. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.